The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
We have made a start. By a list of 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wiggins. Broadcasting for 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wiggins.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Space Show program for Friday. It's morning here in the Pacific time zone, which is where we're located. And I hope it's a great day wherever you are listening to today's Space Show program. Terrific guest with Laura Montgomery in a few minutes. But first, a couple of very quick announcements. This will be a 60-minute format show. So if you do want to call us at 866-687-7223, please watch the clock so you can get your call in. And we hope you do call. That is our preferred way of your communicating with the Space Show and our guest. You can, of course, use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. A couple of other very quick announcements. The Sunday program has Dr. A.J. Kothari back with us. And several weeks ago, maybe a month ago, he posted an incredible op-ed on the Howard Bloom email list on why we should be going to space, settle in space, why space is so important and valuable. And I thought it was really a good discussion. So I invited AJ back to talk about that. And that is this Sunday, March 5th. And then I want to call to your attention Tuesday, March 7th. It's a double Space Show program. So starting 9:30 in the morning, again, West Coast time, Dr. Heinrich Paas in Germany is with us with a good phone line this time, not the one he tried to use in Spain last week. And his new book is called The One, How an Ancient Idea Holds the Future of Physics. And he talks about quantum physics and monism, M-O-N-I-S-M. Now, on the program from last Friday that was a bust because of his Spanish phone line with his cell phone, there are some videos posted on the blog, and you might want to go refer to that blog page and check out some of the videos there with Dr. Paas himself, plus other commentary on his book that you might find interesting and useful before the program Tuesday morning, again at 9:30 a.m. Tuesday evening is our typical Space Show program for Tuesday. Dr. Alan Hale, the astronomer, and the Hale of Hale-Bopp is going to talk to us about comets and related astronomical features, given the comet that has been in the sky of late, although it's kind of hard to see with the naked eye. And then you can check out the newsletters for the rest of the programming. So those are the announcements that I would like to talk about. So again, the phone line is 866-687-7223. The newsletter goes out early Monday morning, 6 a.m. If you want a copy of it, please make sure I have your email address. Remember, we archive everything. We do have a Space Show store. If you're interested in T-shirts and logo wear, go to the picture of Pepper the Husky listening to the Space Show on the website, and she will take you to our Space Show store. And then, of course, always the most important is that we are a listener-supported radio program, a 501c3 nonprofit, and now a Nevada nonprofit corporation. And we are able to do these shows because many of you do financially support us as a nonprofit. If you're a federal taxpayer, you do get your discount. Discount's probably the wrong word. Deduction off of federal income taxes. And if you want any more information, check with me or your tax advisor. And the best way to support us is PayPal, and we do have a large PayPal button upper right side of our homepage. You can't miss it. And if you use Zelle, we do that too. The email address for Zelle is david@onegiantleapfoundation.org. And then if you want to mail a check to One Giant Leap, the Las Vegas office address is on the PayPal button and on our website. We also have sponsors and billboard advertisers. They get the banner ad going across the homepage. They get a shout-out on every single show. And on the longer format shows, the sponsors get a message that I read. So if you're interested in sponsorship, let us know. We thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, ASTROCS, AIAA, the National Space Society, and also Dr. Ben Arroyo with his great books for being sponsors and advertisers. And again, you can get more information if you email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our guest today is noted space attorney and frequent space show guest, Laura Montgomery, and she spent more than two decades with the FAA. She was manager of the space law branch in the FAA's office of the chief counsel, and before that she was FAA's senior attorney for commercial space transportation. I want to spend time talking with Laura and not reading about her, but her full bio is posted on our website. I urge you to read about her and know a little bit about her background. As I said, we would like to talk to Laura. So, Laura, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you, please?
Oh, thank you. I'm great. I really appreciate your invitation, David. I always love chatting with you.
Always. On recent Space Show programs, we did a look at the new year in advance, you know, those kinds of things, and I always brought up asking the guest, what's your opinion? Is the moratorium on space regulation going to be renewed or modified by the regulators since it finally comes to a screeching halt on October 1st of this year unless they do something about it? So commercial space is a lot more important and also more important for national security space, as we've seen with Ukraine. But does that influence what they're going to do with the moratorium? Any ideas on how that will go?
Well, this is a super interesting question, and I actually just wrote a short paper on it. And the bottom line for me is I hope that they extend the moratorium. But there's a lot of confusion out there as to what the moratorium entails, and it is pretty much limited to protecting occupant safety, and it doesn't apply to the FAA's longstanding mandate to protect the public on the ground. So, as I think you know, the FAA has authority to license and regulate launch and reentry. In other words, going to space and coming back, but they don't have authority on orbit. And so if you have an expendable launch vehicle with the payload, you know, just an object like a satellite, that's something the FAA has been licensing forever. And when I say forever, I mean, you know, since the 1980s. But so there's no moratorium on the FAA protecting people on the ground because, you know, these big, large rockets that go to orbit, a very high explosive yields, and you wouldn't want one landing on people or buildings. It would be horrible destruction. So in the United States, we say it's better to launch over water, and we require them to have a destruct system on board so that they can blow it up before it reaches land or people. So that authority is in place. There's no moratorium on it. It's all good. The FAA has never had authority on orbit. So when there's people on, like a Dragon spacecraft, there is no FAA license attached to that at all. So the moratorium has no effect on that. It's just unregulated activity.
Does any government agency have any regulatory authority on orbit, or is it totally unregulated?
Oh, well, the FCC and NOAA both regulate satellites on orbit. And frankly, you know, as we all know, when the Dragon goes to orbit, it's going to the space station and it's operating under contract with NASA. So there's plenty of contractual requirements in place from a government agency, but not a regulatory agency like the FAA.
Okay.
So it's not the Wild West out there at all. But what this moratorium does apply to is the safety of people on board. And the law that Congress passed, which is popularly referred to as the Commercial Space Launch Act, defines three types of people on board: crew, spaceflight participants, and government astronauts. And the crew are the pilot and any, other employees of a launch operator. And the spaceflight participants are what you and I might think of as passengers. And, of course, the government astronauts are people who work for NASA or some other government agency and who are there as part of their job. Or international partner astronauts, astronauts from, other governments, Spain, the UK, what have you. So what the moratorium says is that the FAA may not implement regulations governing the design or operation of a launch or reentry vehicle where the regulations are meant to protect the people on board, unless the FAA is responding to an actual event where there has been a death, serious injury, or an event that could have led to a death or serious injury. We'll call it a close call for short. And so the FAA has the ability to write regulations, but only if something bad has happened. And I have a couple of reasons for saying that I think the moratorium should be extended. One is it's just not been the number of flights originally envisioned when this moratorium was put in place back in 2004. And also because, I have three reasons really. Because the second reason is there are regulations that protect people on board, because remember what I said about the FAA's protecting people on the ground?
Uh-huh.
Well, part of the way that's done, if there's, a pilot on board, is the pilot might fly the vehicle away from, a populated area. So the pilot is part of the flight safety system. And in order to make sure that the pilot is able to, operate the vehicle properly, the FAA did implement rules to protect that person. So even though they're protecting they want that person protected, it's okay because it's part of their mandate to protect the public on the ground. So those rules are in place, and they have this happy effect of also protecting the other people who are not crew on board. For instance, one of the regulations is there must be an environmental control and life support system that provides enough air and the proper concentrations of oxygen. And when you're figuring out whether there's enough air for the pilot, you have to make sure there's enough air for everyone else so they don't use up his air or her air. So there's a pretty good knock-on effect of these regulations that do help everyone on board, not just the crew. So there's sort of already some safety provisions in place. Then the other thing is that when Congress first passed the law for human spaceflight to be regulated by the FAA, the industry was predicting 10,000 flights in the next few years. And that was going to provide plenty of data to determine what kind of regulations to pass, which ones were necessary and which ones weren't. And as we know, we have not had 10,000 flights since 2004, far with people on board, it's been far, far short of that. So, so Congress eventually said to the FAA, hey, FAA, we'd like a report, please. We'd like to know what you think are the metrics for figuring out when regulations are required. And so the FAA issued a couple of reports, the most recent of which is from 2019. And it said, well, there's three things we're looking at to decide if we, the agency, and the industry are ready for regulation. One is the purpose of space travel. So right now it's adventure travel, right? You know, you go up, you come back to the same place, like a really expensive high-tech roller coaster. All right, yep, I didn't say that about the roller coaster, but, you know. But the FAA said the public expectation of safety is going to go up when space transportation becomes more commonplace. So, like, if you have to go for work because your boss is making you, you're kind of going to be wanting it to be more safe than if you're going, you know, for a joyride, like, you know, the equivalent of parachuting out of an airplane. Uh-huh. Well, that was very fun and exciting, but it could have been dangerous. So, and then ultimately, when it becomes, you know, regular transportation, like airlines and trucks and buses, there will be a very high expectation of safety. And obviously, we haven't even crossed out of adventure travel yet. So, you know, the people who decide to climb mountains and ride motorcycles without helmets or jump out of airplanes with parachutes, but they're still jumping out of an airplane. Those people should get to go to space if they want to, but, you know, their expectations of safety are perhaps, you know, not the highest. So that informed consent can take care of them. And one of the other things that the FAA said would be a sign of whether regulation was necessary was the complexity and size of the industry. I don't quite understand that, so I'm going to skip over it. But then the last one was safety. If the FAA saw actual evidence of unsafe operations or practices, then it might think regulation was necessary. But as of 2019, it had not seen that. So its conclusion was no need yet for regulation. And since then, you know, we haven't seen a lot of changes. We haven't seen a lot more flights. We certainly haven't seen it turn into, you know, space transportation turn into a work environment, as it were. So, you know, that's and like I noted earlier, we don't have the track record yet to regulate effectively.
Is there a commentary period, or are they looking for comments from people? Is there a feedback loop on this issue?
Well, yeah, I think it's called lobbying Congress. The FAA itself isn't deciding this. You know how Congress gives authority to the FAA, and so they said, we're going to tie your hands, no regulation, absent death, serious injury, or close call, until October 1st of 2023. And if no one does anything, that will expire, and then the FAA can issue regulations. Now, issuing regulations does have a comment period. So if the FAA issued a notice of proposed rulemaking where it says, this is what we're thinking of making you do, then the public, which includes the launch operators who are flying people to space, they could file comments and say, this is not a good idea, this is fine, you know, this is too expensive, and it's not worth what it accomplishes, and file comments there. But the moratorium's expiration itself has no official comment period. Just if Congress holds hearings, then that will be a chance for people to comment. And I'm sure that Congress is looking at the report it asked the FAA to prepare. So,
do you think they will hold hearings, or will it just come and go and be extended?
I think there will be hearings, would be my guess, because they have to vote on whether to extend it. And so before they vote on that, they'll want to know, you know, what the FAA is thinking now, 4 years after its report, what industry is thinking and what its predictions are for, you know, the volume of activity, and to look at the safety record and whether maybe there does seem to be some regulation or not. But so that'll be interesting.
Are there,
that'll be interesting to see.
Are you aware of any organizations or interest groups that want to step forward and say regulate? Is there any opposition to extending the moratorium?
Not that I know of, but there are, you know, when you read newspaper articles, they're written in a rather breathless tone that, oh my God, there's no safety measures up there because of this moratorium.
Right.
And so that might propel action where if you dig into a little bit, you'll say, oh, look, there's all sorts of safety for people on board because the FAA is protecting the crew. And, you know, it's not quite the landscape painted in some of these news stories.
So I have the first email question is our friend Todd in San Diego. And he says, I'm surprised that you mentioned space flight participants. I thought that distinguishing definition ceased to exist once commercial space tourism flights started happening a couple of years ago, mostly now on Blue. But I believe there were a few flights that happened on the other companies, including SpaceX. And, of course, SpaceX still has a flight to orbit the moon happening. So, obviously, participants still is the terminology. Can you tell us legally what that really means?
Oh, sure. I'm actually pulling it up, too, while I talk. But, yes, so it is definitely still the term. It is part of the law that Congress passed in 2004. And it, where they defined crew, spaceflight participant, and then later, a number of years later, they added the definition of government astronaut. But a spaceflight participant, if you go to 51 U.S. Code 50902, is a, almost there. Hold on, sorry. Oh, means an individual who is not crew or a government astronaut, carried within a launch vehicle or reentry vehicle. In other words, if I bought a ticket to go up on Blue Origin or Virgin Galactic, I would be a spaceflight participant legally. And maybe what your listener is referring to also is there was a big kerfluffle a little while ago about whether these people were astronauts. But that's more of a policy and marketing issue than a legal issue. So, yes, the folks who are not crew or government astronauts are spaceflight participants.
Is there a legal difference or a liability difference between a space tourist? Because that's what the media does. They say these are the space tourists going up on this, Bezos mission. I don't ever hear them say these are the spaceflight participants. Is there a distinguishing factor between a space tourist and a participant?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm a lawyer, so I'm way more boring than the people saying space tourist. So I kind of have to say spaceflight participant. But yes, these are spaceflight participants who are going up for tourism purposes. A spaceflight participant might go up for work. If Coca-Cola sends someone to the space station to check how the bubbles act in space in a bottle of Coke, that person would be a spaceflight participant. But he would be, you know, a Coke employee. So so there's legally, if you're a tourist, you're probably legally a spaceflight participant. And, it's interesting you ask about liability. Because right now, until 2025, a spaceflight participant does have to sign a waiver agreeing not to sue the launch operator who he or she is getting a ride from. So that what we call they're called cross waivers, and the launch operator agrees not to see the spaceflight participant, and it's all very, very neutral. But there is a waiver of liability because you are knowingly taking on a bunch of risk.
So I've always wondered this, so you're a good person to ask this. Mr. Joe signs the waiver because he wants to fly on the damn thing. And his family is maybe okay, maybe lukewarm. And the thing blows up on the pad and everybody gets killed. So the kids and the wife sue the launch operator. And they say, we never signed the damn thing. We didn't want him to go. So do we have any, does the wife, do the kids have any ability to sue the launch operator because the daddy who went and got killed doesn't have any legal documentation saying he is signing for and speaking for his family members? Or does he have that documentation?
Well, that's very interesting because so there's another waiver he has to sign agreeing not to sue the U.S. government.
Okay.
And in those are written up in the FAA's regulations. And in those regulations, it says no one, that if someone else sues on the participant's behalf, like his estate, his wife or his children, then the participant's estate will indemnify the launch operator for claims brought by someone else for his loss. So, you know, the wife is sad and has lost her husband's income or what have you, and is suing for that harm. The husband's, you know, his estate is supposed to make up the difference if the court says, yeah, let's say you owe Mr. Launch Operator, you owe the wife $1 million. And so then it would get paid out of the husband's estate, which is, of course, the wife's. So this is also, this is supposed to deter anyone from suing because at the end of the day, they won't actually come out ahead if the estate is big enough. And right now, with the price of those tickets, the people buying them are probably going to have a decent sized estate.
So the real life thing would be, the guy signs on these papers, the kids, especially if they're minor kids, and the wife probably have no clue what he's signing, and he's probably not fully disclosed or adequately disclosed or anything to the family, so they have no idea that the estate is indemnifying them. I mean, it would seem to me that that might be an easy thing to punch holes into because they weren't fully informed and they weren't told that their rights were being signed away by this guy.
I'm not a tort lawyer, but, you know, those regulations are designed to forestall that. And if you're writing writing cross waivers for the launch company, I do know that lawyers will go and borrow liberally from the existing cross waivers in the FAA's regulations. You know, that get signed for the government. So I would imagine that there's a lot of similarity between the two. And I know that there is for some. So, you know, that's what it's in there for, is to stop that.
Why?
And it's in a regulation. So that makes it more likely to be upheld in court.
Why 2025? Does it expires in 2025 or has to be renewed? What happens in 2025?
In 2025, the requirement that the spaceflight participant waive claims against the operator, that was like it passed in 2015.
Uh-huh.
And it gave industry 10 years of, you know, presumably many, many launches before they had to worry about the liability exposure. Sort of while we're learning and we're telling them through informed consent that it's dangerous, then, you know, we shouldn't be facing big lawsuits. While we're learning and they're learning too. We're all in this together. That's part of the reason for the word participant, you are participating in the flight and the risk.
In 2025, this is going to be a kind of a similar issue as to whether this gets renewed and extended or whether it abruptly ends, because for sure the number of flights will not have taken place that they anticipated over 10 years.
Yeah, definitely. I doubt we'll be at 10,000 flights by then. Yes, it will expire. So if there's no votes, if Congress, just busies itself with other things and never votes on this, it will expire, and it will no longer be a federal requirement that the spaceflight participant waive claims against the operator.
So then I would imagine the operator, before flying someone, would probably give them paperwork to sign where they agree to that, right?
Yes. And, the paperwork also contains the informed consent provisions, and those are really interesting. They say that the operator, and this is, Congress passed this law and the FAA is enforcing it. It says the operator must tell the spaceflight participants that the vehicle, that the government has not certified this vehicle as safe. That you must tell them the safety record of the vehicle, and that they could be hurt or killed. So, you're kind of put on notice that bad things could happen, and that your usual expectations of safety, like when you get on, a commercial airline, they should not be the same.
Have you ever seen these forms from Blue Origin for these suborbital flights? Have you ever gotten a chance to review any of them or look at them?
Well, I don't like to talk about specific companies in case they are or have been a client, but I will say that I have helped draft such things, yes.
For the company, not for the individual.
For company. Right. I've done some work for some companies.
So if you get your flight pro bono from the operator, does that make any difference?
No.
Okay. So we'll have another sort of moratorium coming up in 2 years after this one in October.
Yeah, I would call it a requirement rather than a moratorium.
Okay.
But yeah. And oh, by the way, I should say this. I use the word moratorium because I was at the FAA for a long time, but industry prefers the term learning period to moratorium. This is the learning period where we figure things out without the FAA telling us to do things. And for all we know, the FAA will tell us to do the wrong thing because they don't know much more than we do. So, I just need to make sure I'm the record straight there.
Another email is Sharon in Seattle, and Sharon says, what if there is a clear case of negligence on the part of the crew that causes a really bad accident? Maybe the pilot was on drugs or was drunk and somehow managed to still fly the ship or something like that. Is there any liability against the crew members themselves? Or if there really is negligence, like being drunk or drugged out or something of that order, does it negate any of these agreements?
Arguably, gross negligence could negate the agreements. And some of the ones that are in the FAA's regulations specifically call out gross negligence. And if someone's drunk, I think that that's more in the order of gross negligence that these waivers are not supposed to apply to.
Because there have been pilots that have showed up to be drunk, but, very few of them ever make it off the ground.
Right. And as for whether, you would sue the pilot individually, I think, people do that. But because they're operating in their capacity as an employee, I think it winds up being a lawsuit against the company. But if some tort lawyer said I had that wrong, I would defer to that person.
Carl is in Austin, Texas, and he says, if I can, I'd like to ask you a different line of questioning. The war in Ukraine has seen commercial operations being used for military purposes, and you've also heard some of the military, some of the commercial companies distance themselves from their hardware being used for military purposes. I'm wondering if they're at all doing services for the government. Do they have any ability to say no military, but will serve in other ways? Or if they're working or doing something for the government with their space assets, do they take the military along with other purposes? I'm thinking specifically of SpaceX and Starlink.
So there's a long history of commercial companies providing services to the military, from building aircraft to rockets to, you know, military satellites. So I'm a little unclear on what the question is. I mean, there's definitely, you know, lots of military and commercial intersections.
Carl, if you want to send in a note, or better yet, give us a call and clarify, that's fine. But my hunch is Carl is thinking of comments that have been made by SpaceX people saying that they didn't intend Starlink to be a military asset in the Ukrainian war to serve as a military purpose. And that was not what they were intending in bringing internet services to the area. So he may be referring to comments that SpaceX executives Gwynn Shotwell has made in the past about that kind of, I'll use the term dual use, although I'm not sure that that's even appropriate. But once they've got the constellation up there and it's providing information and the U.S. military gets that information and that information is useful in running the war, I suspect that, you know, SpaceX wouldn't have a whole lot of choice on how that information is used, right?
No, I wouldn't think so. I mean, especially if the military is just, you know, acting as another customer, where, is it like the telephone company doesn't know what I'm saying, I hope. You know, they'd be very bored. But, you know, if I'm talking on the phone, the telephone company has no interest in, shouldn't, or ability to control what I'm saying just because I'm using their telephone lines.
Listeners, there's time if you would like to call and talk to us today, 866-687-7223. And you can also use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. So if you have questions and maybe on a different topic, that's totally fine. I have another question, and this is Paul in, he says, upstate New York. And Paul says, is commercial space, do you think, here to stay as part of the asset base for the U.S. government, or has the Ukrainian war elevated commercial space to a certain status that may not be long-lasting if the war ever gets resolved?
Oh, I think it's here to stay. And I think that one of the, and this is just, you know, from reading the news, I think that the military is looking at ways it can leverage commercial assets, you know, more explicitly just because of Ukraine.
So this would sort of secure a positive regulatory environment for commercial space going forward. Would that be a fair statement to say in a rational world?
Well, in a rational world, sure, David.
I had to qualify it.
But I think the regulatory environment is independent of the national security environment in many ways. So I don't know that it would become positive or not. And of course, we could discuss what positive means. But sure, in a rational world, yes. And there's been commercial space around for decades now between, you know, commercial satellites for remote sensing, commercial satellites for communications, television, you know, broadcast and direct TV, et cetera, and also, you know, pure voice communications. And also the space transportation sector has been commercial since the 80s. So, you know, it's entrenched. And I hope it's going to do well and continue. And I think the predictions are that it will. You know, agencies like NASA have become much more open to having less involvement in how to design things and build things and having their people all over them and saying, look, if you can get us the space, we want to buy the ride, but we're not going to buy the vehicle. More of a taxi model than buying the truck.
Another email, John in Oklahoma City. And listeners, you can give us a call if you're available. It's a lot more interesting than emails. But anyway, I make this pitch all the time, and I get the same result all the time. So maybe I'm insane. Anyway, it's 1-866-687-7223. John in Oklahoma City says, most of what I understand you saying has to do with launch companies and participants on launch and possibly reentry. But if we take, for example, the Dear Moon mission that may materialize in the next year or two with SpaceX, where they loop around the moon, if some sort of a fatal destructive accident happened as it was looping around the moon, and it has nothing to do with launch or reentry, are these provisions about not suing the company or the government or somebody still in place? Do they hold for 100% of the mission, regardless of where the mission takes place, or are they only unique to launch and reentry?
Well, that is a very good question, and I believe, if memory serves, and you'd have to check me, that it's just for launch and reentry. Now, a company is free to require a participant to sign more, but what's federally mandated applies to the licensed activity, and that is only launch and reentry.
So if the company did not have you sign more and somehow destroyed the ship in orbit around the moon, that company might still then have liability regardless?
There might be liability exposure, yeah. I mean, you know, it's not like automatic just because something bad happened that a company has to pay. There's still all sorts of work to be figured out, like were they at fault? I mean, if they were hit by an alien vessel, then that's not their fault. So that was a frivolous example, of course. But you know, it's not liability isn't automatically found just because something bad happened. You have to have fault and negligence, as your earlier listener mentioned.
Would be really interested if they got hit by a satellite. So I can imagine how that might end up, because satellite collisions don't ever seem to get resolved, do they?
Well, I think someone pays someone something eventually, even if it's only the insurance company. there's rules about, you know, manned activity in space, and the other people are supposed to keep the probabilities of collisions below a certain threshold. So, like on launch, you're supposed to only launch if your probabilities are correct. Like, you're not going to come within X probability of hitting the space station.
Jake, Dallas, Texas, and he says, David, I'm at work, so I can't call you, but I can sneak in an email. So he says, many of us, as you know, are absolutely committed to and looking forward to the day when space settlement comes. There have been discussions from time to time and comments made even by Elon Musk regarding what kind of law or who will make the law and the regulations for settlers on Mars. What is the existing law if humans end up in some sort of a village or settlement on the moon or Mars? Do they go with the launching company's law? Do they create their own law? Is it the Wild Wild West on the settlement or on the habitat or however you want to describe it?
Oh, wow. Well, I can say that, first of all, I want to say it's not the Wild West. I once got quoted as saying something was the Wild West, and I'm like, I never said that. I'm sure I never said that. But anyway, not the Wild West. But there is, and Congress has not passed the law about commercial, let's say, lunar settlement or Martian settlement or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
So the Outer Space Treaty does require governments to authorize and supervise their nationals in outer space, but under U.S. law, we haven't set that in motion yet. So there's no law there yet. However, a company could say, look, these are the rules you're going to, if you're on my property, or these are the rules that you have to agree to operate under before you go. I'm not going to take you unless you agree to them, and it's, you know, going to be like no hitting and no killing anyone, et cetera, et cetera. Now, criminal law does apply to the space station. I would have to check again to see if it's written broadly enough to apply to any old U.S. habitat, whether in orbit or the moon. But, you know, you're not allowed to kill people in space under U.S. law. So there's at least that much. So the earlier statement, not the Wild West.
So,
but you could probably, you know, a settlement could make up its own rules too. Right now, it's very open-ended.
Interesting, and so they could create Martian law. Would the people back on the ground on Earth be sort of required to follow and respect Martian-made law, or would they just say, nonsense, you went up on a U.S. ship and it's our law?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, it depended on whether, you know, they seceded. But I write science fiction, but as in my day job as a space lawyer, I'm like really near term. And I think that, you know, if a U.S. company went to the moon and started operating on the moon and did bad things, that, you know, all of their assets and bank accounts are here on Earth. And any regulations or rules they are violating, they could be enforced against here. So there's this, you know, very near term, all the stuff you're doing on outer space, you still got your assets here on the ground, and you could be fined or have civil penalties issued against you, et cetera, if you do something you're not supposed to do. Assuming there's a law that applies.
On
the criminal side, I think there is.
It's going to be really interesting to see how this unfolds, because I think we will see people on the moon in some sort of settlement or village, and the same thing in and on Mars. I hope I'm around to see Mars. But if it's orbiting an orbital station, and you said that there's no regulations for being in orbit per se, is that more complex than being on the surface of a planet or the moon?
I would have to double check, because I know the criminal code applies on the space station. I think it applies in orbiting habitats too. So if you kill an American, or you're an American who kills someone else, U.S. law applies to you.
And if somebody kills a French person, it would be French people, French law that would apply?
You'd have to ask a French lawyer that. I don't know if they have laws applying extraterritorially to outer space, extraterrestrially, I should say, to outer space like we do. We have a specific congressionally passed law in Title 18 that says, you know, criminal laws apply in outer space.
Ben is in Florida. He doesn't say where in Florida, but he says a little while ago, you said their assets and bank accounts and things are all here on Earth. Well, maybe not. Maybe they have a claim that is even valid under the Outer Space Treaty, and they're doing something commercial on the moon or an asteroid. Suddenly they have an asset not on Earth. How does that work, and how could you attach or go after an asset that was not on Earth?
Well, all I was saying is you wouldn't need to, because there are, and this is, you know, very near term, so in the next 50 years, let's say, anyone working an asteroid with his robots is going to have bank accounts and assets here on Earth that could be attached. If, like, let's say they were threatening Earth with their asteroid. you know, he could be stopped.
From your experience, the people that are planning these activities, and there's no shortage of people talking about planning and writing business plans for these kinds of activities, do they ever take into consideration or contact you and say, how do we structure things legally? I don't mean how do they structure a prospectus to raise money, but do they care about some kind of legal structure on the asteroid they propose to mine or the lunar colony they propose to work? Do they even,
absolutely. Yes.
They are thinking about it.
Absolutely, yes. And in fact, there's a whole initiative that comes and goes over the time for getting some of these other activities supervised and authorized. The Outer Space Treaty says that governments are supposed to, you know, regulate their nationals in outer space. And so a lot of people worry about that and want to be regulated. I find that interesting because, you know, being regulated is expensive and it slows you down. So if you're doing something that's really not going to expose anyone to any hazards, like let's say you're mining an asteroid or the moon with robots, there's no environmental concerns, there's no no worker safety, no one is near you. It's like, why do you want to be regulated? But they do. People are worried about it. People in the industry take their obligations very seriously, and there's constant attempts to think this through and figure out how to do it. There's other people in industry who say, look, let's not have too much regulation too soon. Let's wait until we need it, because it's really hard. Space is not easy. I mean, movies and science fiction make it look easy, but really, look how long it's taken us to get back to the moon. Well, we haven't yet.
Well, we're not there yet.
Exactly. You're right. And so it's sort of a let's get there before you start thinking of telling me how to do it. I don't even know how to do it. And you certainly don't, so don't tell me what to do. But there's a very lively, ongoing policy debate about that very issue.
And, of course, we're going back to the moon with a bunch of international partners from a multitude of different cultures. So I guess there's going to be some jurisdictional issues as to whose culture, whose law.
Well, I think the way to think about it under existing law is everyone's responsible for their own people. Each government has to, you know, especially when it's government personnel, they're going to follow their government's rules.
So we'll have a mini United Nations on the moon.
Sure. Yeah. It will be very multicultural. It will be cool. It'll be very cool.
It'll be fascinating to watch it develop and unfold. That is for sure. What is 2020? Okay. What do you think 2023 holds for space and space policy? Have you been sort of looking in the crystal ball? Is this going to be a record-setting banner year? More successes? Are the legal concerns or the regulatory concerns going to slow anything down?
Well, I have no crystal ball. I think people should keep an eye on what the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is up to. It put out a notice of inquiry on in-space assembly and manufacture, so things like refueling and servicing satellites, debris remediation, you know, bringing things out of orbit so they can burn up in the atmosphere. Because right now they're couching a lot of their questions in, how should we, do we need to change our licenses so that we help enable you guys as you're doing these things? But then they also sneak in a few things that are really outside of their jurisdiction, I think. Some of it's, you know, the FCC is supposed to regulate transmissions to and from within the United States and look at frequencies and make sure people are not interfering with each other, so they can, like, look at your power levels, make sure you're not drowning out the radio station next door, things like that. But they tend to try to do more than Congress told them to. So, you know, keep a close eye on them, on the FCC. So that one, that could be a source of regulatory drag. But otherwise, you know, I hope that all the different companies have lots of successful space tourism and other flights, you know, that takes folks to the ISS for work, and other companies that are taking tourists up, and I hope they do well. I mean, we'll see how it goes.
Are you seeing any signs of economic drag on any aspects of the industry, given the economic issues going on in the country today? Is that showing up anywhere in your peripheral?
Not that I can tell about. You know, I'm a lawyer, so I'm not predicting big economic patterns here.
Cyber currency in space. I mean, I'm reading and hearing a lot more about things like that. In fact, I just got an email for you for that. Wow.
Okay.
This is from John. I'll read the email and then I'll take your phone call. This is from, notice how they wait until the show's just about to end. And then,
I have a few minutes.
So John in Fremont, California says many space companies are pushing for cryptocurrency to be used for space commerce to avoid the problem you mentioned, i.e. control of assets on Earth. If servers and financial infrastructure is established off Earth, where they use blockchain tech that can't be controlled by the feds, won't that make it easier for self-governance of space settlements?
Probably. If you set it up that way, it probably would make it easier.
So
But again, I think that's for decades from now.
So the question I would have for John and others is, once you set this up, how long would it take government to regain their power and pass regulations that attempt to deal with what you've accomplished? So I think that would be a pretty quick transformation for government. Now, you might be able to sue them and forestall it, but I don't think government would give up their control that easily because you came up with a way to do something in space. That's my own hunch.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you, David.
But I'm cynical about government. So. Here, let's see who your caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. It's Tony Cook calling from, actually today, at UCLA.
Well, you're still in Los Angeles, so
yeah,
you haven't
still
traveled
in the area.
Very far. That's right. What's up?
Well, I have just a brief question. I noticed on social media that a lot of people who I suppose are sort of SpaceX opponents, like, they mock SpaceX by pointing out that Starship still doesn't have an FAA license to fly. And I was wondering if you can actually explain, is there any really significance to that? I mean, do they have to request a license to fly when they're ready, which is what I would think. But is there any significance to that yet?
So, you know, I try not to comment on specific companies, but I can give you the general process, which is if you're going to
launch that's really what I'm asking.
In the United States, you need an FAA license. So, Technically, the FAA is supposed to give you a decision within 180 days of your application. They have actually figured out ways to make it take much longer, but they're supposed to issue it within 180 days of application. So that's a thing. You do need a license, and you shouldn't launch without one.
Well, okay, but I know SpaceX has been saying that they plan to launch this month with Starship. And are you surprised that no license has been announced being issued yet, or will it just be announced when they actually have a date to launch?
Well,
I mean,
so
has anything really unusual?
Hey, Tony, come on, let her talk. You're drowning her out.
Okay.
I didn't mean to interrupt. When I was at the FAA, there were definitely occasions where we issued licenses very shortly before the launch date. That happens.
Okay. All right. So, but do you see anything unusual with this?
He's not giving up.
No. No.
Okay. All right. Well, that's really all I was wondering. I just didn't think they had a big point to make, really.
It happens that licenses don't get issued way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call.
Sure. Thank you for calling.
Tony, thanks
for
your call. Appreciate it. They'll probably at the last minute have their license and the details of it. I don't think SpaceX would launch without the license.
So, I doubt it.
So
I wouldn't imagine that would happen.
There is some talk about the need to human certify, Starship when it gets ready to call to take humans on board. What actually is human certification for a rocket? That's probably not the right terminology.
No, there is no terminology. Well, it's actually NASA terminology.
Okay.
It probably originally was called man certified. But NASA has what it thinks of as a certification process for launch vehicles. It's not anything remotely like the FAA certification process for airliners.
Uh-huh.
The history of like the shuttle can attest. So calling for man certification is calling for something very mysterious, or human certification, because the FAA does not have a process for that. And as, the moratorium makes clear, it's not allowed to. until October, and even after that, certification is just another word for authorization and certification, license, exemption, waiver. These are all just forms of authorizations. So saying it needs to be human certified is just saying it needs to have a lot of testing done, and it's harder to test rockets because until SpaceX came along, you threw away most of your rocket.
So then the human certification is a company decision based on the company's protocols for how they want to test their vehicle as to whether they feel they're ready to fly humans or not.
It can be, yes. Yes. It could be NASA's human certification. It could be the company's certification. Can't be the FAA's. They don't have that authority. And the FAA's space side only has the authority to license. It doesn't have the authority like the aviation side. The aviation side will certificate the hardware, not just the operations. The space side only licenses operations, not the hardware.
And so nobody's other than the company is approving the hardware. Is that right?
Correct. Right. There's no like gold seal of approval put onto the hardware.
Good.
The FAA reviews the hardware because it wants Like if you have very, very treacherous hardware, they may never let you fly over land. But if you have very reliable hardware, then maybe they could change that determination. Your operations will be driven by the reliability of your hardware, but what they're officially approving is your operations on the space side.
So for liability issues, should there be an accident, then there would be an investigation as to whether the company had reasonable and proper testing and protocols for their vehicle, since it's likely
a lawsuit.
If there's a lawsuit.
But the FAA's own investigation would govern compliance with its license and the regulations, and they are for operations.
So the FAA would be okay if humans went up on the Starship test, because they don't have any rules about that, correct?
We do. I mean, they do. The FAA has rules about testing, and it says you can't carry participants during the first test.
Okay.
Because you don't want the pilots distracted.
So, but they can carry pilots on the first test.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. A pilot or crew, you know, not just pilots.
It's already complicated enough. They sure as hell don't need to keep adding to it. Because
it's all written down, so someone who wants to know what it says can find it in the Code of Federal Regulations. But yes, it's you have to read it carefully and you have to read it like a robot. They say it's supposed to say what it means and mean what it says.
But you probably need a PhD in searching legal and government documents to know how to find something.
Well, I can find it, and I'm not a PhD.
But you're an attorney that worked in the FAA. You know how to do it and how it's coded. So a normal person would probably really struggle to get all this information.
Well, I think that if they're, you know, under 40, they know how to do Google searches for sure. And so you plug in Code of Federal Regulations and Human Spaceflight and FAA, and you'll find 14 CFR Chapter 3, I hope.
So is there anything else on the horizon that we should keep our eyes open for on 2023?
Well, there's one this one has been on the horizon for a long time now, but I keep my eye on it, and that's the FAA still has on its unified agenda plans to do another orbital debris rulemaking. So maybe that notice will come out this year. We'll see.
So it's on their agenda, but they've never acted on it.
Right.
Is there any hint to FAA thinking about orbital debris removal?
About removal? So far the FAA's debris rules are all about mitigation, about preventing it.
Okay.
And so we'll have to see what this next rule is about. It might be more mitigation. It might be mitigation and removal. I don't know. We'll see.
I do a lot of interviews with entrepreneurial companies that are working on various debris plans from removal to mitigation. So I know there's investment and activity going on in the fields.
Excellent. Very good.
If there were going to be rules coming up, I bet these companies would sure like to know what they're going to be.
Absolutely. Yes, because if we get a little far-fetched and someone sends up a space tug to take things out of orbit, you know, they'll have a lot of legal issues.
There are companies building space tugs and talking about deploying them, fairly quickly. So they're going to need special rules for working a space tug.
A lot of it can be contractual. Like, so if I have a dead satellite, I might want to hire one of them to get my dead satellite out of orbit sooner than, you know, the 10 years it might take to decay on its own. I actually wrote a science fiction novel about this. It's called Manx Prize, and it's about a prize for the first person to, you know, bring in a huge piece of debris burn it up in the atmosphere. So I thought through a lot of the requirements, and I think you really could just do it contractually.
In today's world.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, we may see that happen, because I was just doing a show with somebody, and they were talking about the tugs that are already getting ready to be deployed, and that some of their commercial business might be contractual debris issues. So we may see that.
Well, who were you talking to? I want to go listen to that episode.
Let me see if I can look at my list of recent shows and tell you who did that. If not, it'll be one of those things where I'll have to get back to you. Let's see. I think it was Joe Carroll.
Joe Carroll. Okay.
Yeah, from, do you know him?
No.
So he talks a lot about artificial gravity, but he did a show with a PowerPoint presentation on February 26th. It's CARROLL, broadcast 3990. So I think Joe might have been one who talked about that. And I think Clay Mowry, you might know Clay.
Oh, yeah.
So he was back on the show February 21st, and he also talked about a lot of different kinds of business activity and things that were going on. So I think it might have been Joe or Clay. Clay was February 21st.
Okay. And they talked about contractual elements of...
Well, they talked about space tugs, and I said, do space tugs already exist? And he said, yeah, that companies are designing them and building them and getting ready to deploy them, and they may be able to remove debris and other kinds of issues. So maybe a listener hearing this show will post a better comment on which shows talked about it in recent times, and then I will see their blog postings, and I can tell you. But it has come up, and space tugs have definitely come up with various guests because there are investment dollars and R&D flowing into that. So we may see something along those lines in the not-too-distant future.
Cool. That is very cool.
But I think one of those two might be the show I'm thinking of. But hopefully I'll get some help from listeners, and they can be more precise, and I can email you that information.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
Anything we've missed that, or anything else you'd like to point out to us?
No. I think we've covered a good bit today. I really, really enjoy chatting with you, David. I think these shows are great.
Thank you very much, and enjoy talking to you again, and I'm sure we'll do so again in the near future. So
you
thank
bet.
You. And listeners, that's it for today. Remember, Dr. Kothari is back on Sunday, and then the double shows on Tuesday, March 7th. Everybody have a great weekend. As always, play hard and work hard and be safe and healthy and keep looking up. So goodbye from Laura, David, and the Space Show.